The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. This program will take you behind the scenes and deepen your understanding about the patterns and perspectives of leadership today. Now, here's your host, John Schmidt.
Well, hello. Welcome again, everyone, to this week's edition of Zoomed Leadership. I am your host, John Schmidt. And again today, as every week, and actually as I love to do every week, I'll be taking you out to the big picture, into the up close and personal, and toward a world of desirable futures. Of course, those that are rich, as I say, with the essence of constant renewal. Well, folks, it has been quite a week. Markets in turmoil for sure. The volatility has been intense, and I got to say, at times rather staggering. And conversations everywhere, perhaps, at least to some extent, seem to have revolved around the propensity for weathering the debt supercycle and the financial implications that come with it. And as a backdrop, or perhaps as a subtext to most of the conversations I have seen and certainly been privy to, is the focal point of growth. Will we get it? How do we stimulate it? What will be the coming election, and how might that actually have an implication or bearing on emphasis on jobs and growth? And today we want to continue our focus on growth and specifically the end of growth. Because our guest today, again, for part two of our conversation, is Richard Heinberg. The title of his book that we introduced last time was The End of Growth, Adapting to Our New Economic Reality. We got started last time, and for those that weren't here on that show, recall that Richard is Senior Fellow in Residence at Post Carbon Institute, author of 9 award-winning books, including The Party's Over, Powderhorn, Peak Everything, and Blackout. Today is part two of the show that we began on July 25th, and we actually rebroadcast it on August 1st as an encore show. Richard, great to have you back to continue this conversation.
Well, it's great to be back with you, John.
Yeah, I think felt like we were getting started, and we had a lot that we were getting under the table, but a lot to go here. But Richard, maybe I know that there are some listeners that may not have been with us on the first show, or to a refresher with some others. Maybe we can start off at the bigger picture again about why growth is ending and the big deal about it all.
Sure. Yeah, well, just about everyone is concerned that our economy is in a sustained rough patch. Started back in 2007. The thesis in my book is that this is actually something of historic significance, that we've had a growth-based economy for the past few decades, somewhat since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but especially during the most of the 20th century. And we've gotten to take that for granted as sort of something that's natural and normal and inevitable. But as I describe in the book, there are reasons to think this was sort of a one-time-only experience in world history, because it was based mostly on the abundance of cheap fossil fuels that we had available to us during most of the 20th century. Now, in the 21st century, we're in a different situation. It's not that we're running out of oil or natural gas or coal, but we've used up the low-hanging fruit. And what's left is going to be more costly, both in terms of requirement for investment and also in terms of the environmental risks. There are alternative energy sources available, but they just don't have the kind of economic payoff that fossil fuels had in the early days. This is not to say we shouldn't be developing alternative energy sources. We shouldn't. We certainly should. But again, it's they're going to have very different characteristics in terms of their ability to operate a fast-paced industrial economy. So we are at a turning point, and as we discussed last time, there are several factors leading into that. The disappearance of the low-hanging fruit in the energy world, and the same thing is true in minerals and metals. And then there is a huge debt overhang that we've built up over the past few decades. We forgot that it's energy and materials that make the money go round, and we lured ourselves into thinking that it's money that makes the world go round. So we kept, in order to keep growth happening, we piled up more and more debt, consumer debt, corporate debt, and government debt. And now the bills are coming due just as we're realizing that all of the resources that we depend on are getting more expensive. So food costs are rising, oil prices have been very high in recent years, and they don't look like they're going down. So we find ourselves at this really scary moment in history where the old rules just don't work anymore.
You know, Richard, it strikes me, listening to all the conversations that I tune into on Bloomberg and CNN and many of the financial kinds of conversations, there's always the discussion around growth and about whether the economy is slowing down and so forth. But little or none of it that I hear in the mainstream actually is talking about the fact that growth may have, you know, reached a crescendo and we're now on that downside or at least flat. What's your sense about that, Richard? Well, I mean, why is this sort of not so much in the mainstream?
Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. First of all, the economic orthodoxy that's come into place in the last few decades was built up during this anomalous period of time when we had easy growth. And so economists of all stripes tend to believe that it is the normal state of a modern industrial economy, and we can always have it. And they tend to attribute all of that growth to the magic of the market rather than to the abundance of energy and materials that we had during the 20th century. Then there's a political side to this. Liberals tend to believe that stimulus spending by government will boost employment and consumer spending, and then that will flip the economy back into its normal growth setting. But stimulus packages for the past few years have produced anemic and transitory results, and governments just aren't in the position to do much more of that. At the same time, conservatives nurture this faith that if government spending shrinks, you know, if we can get government spending down and under control, that will liberate private enterprise companies to grow profits and jobs. But the thing is, getting government spending under control, what that really looks like is austerity. And countries that have implemented austerity programs tend to show less economic growth than the countries that continue to borrow and spend. Of course, that eventually they run into a brick wall with bond market mayhem. But nevertheless, neither of the prescriptions of the two political camps works anymore, but neither of them wants to admit that, because to do so would be to open the gate to admitting that the other side might be right. What I'm saying, and it's not just me, more and more analysts are starting to come around to this conclusion, what we're saying is that they're both wrong, that economic growth just isn't available anymore. And so we're going to have to recalibrate and rethink our prescriptions for the economy going forward.
And Richard, what strikes me is that in your book and as you're describing now, it's really the larger framing context as the backdrop for the whole enchilada here. I mean, as we have the debt commission about to do its work here this fall to begin to address the Republican and the liberal and the Democrat, Republican, Democrat, liberal and conservative approaches. But there's a larger context, what you're suggesting around that. Can that show up in that conversation, given where we are with it?
Unfortunately, for political reasons, I think it's very unlikely that what we're talking about today is going to show up in the discussions of the folks in Congress, and that's kind of tragic, because that means that if we're right, they're living in kind of a fantasy world, and they're not dealing with the reality. And I think there's plenty of evidence that, in fact, Washington is in a fantasy world, because whatever folks are trying is not working. I said earlier that there are others who are coming to these same conclusions. I want to mention just a couple of folks. Herman Daly, the former World Bank economist, has been saying for decades that growth can't continue, economic growth can't continue forever in a finite world of limited resources. Paul Gilding, the former head of Greenpeace International, has recently come out with a book called The Great Disruption. And in his book, we've had some great conversations about this. He comes to almost exactly the same conclusions that I have in my book, The End of Growth. And Jeremy Grantham, who is the founder of GMO, one of the world's largest investment funds, there's a big feature on him in the New York Times Magazine just this coming weekend. And Jeremy Grantham, again, has come to almost exactly the same conclusions on his own. Grantham and I have never spoken, so we've arrived at our conclusions completely independently. But, when you compare our analyses, they're almost identical. I could probably go on and cite some more people, but I just want to make the point. This is not one, crank who's suggesting this. It's more and more people are coming to this same conclusion.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and I think you do a great job in the book at that, and really the synthesis of it, Richard, is rich in that way. So that really suggests to me, and I guess maybe in the remaining elements of this first segment, this is a big deal, and it's a big deal in that those that are trying to address this won't be able to address it. So what's likely to be our experience, if you're thinking about this, the implications of this then, as we start to address the debt issue and then go downstream with a world of no growth?
Right. Well, we're in for some economic hard times. I think that's baked into the cake at this point. No matter what folks do in Washington, this week or next week or next year, I think we're facing a very, very perilous financial and economic situation over the short term. That's not to say it's the end of the world, and this is really why I wrote the book. I didn't write the book just to depress people and, hey, guess what, folks? It's a bummer from here on out. Might as well slit the wrists now. The point is, if we internalize this, if we understand the situation, we can adapt and adjust. And ultimately, I think we'll actually have a better economy as a result.
Well, Richard, I think that the adapt and adjust, I think, is right on. But I've got to say, you're really echoing much of what our conversation has been in the last months, and certainly for this year. So it's fabulous to get your words and your perspective on it. But I hear the music in my ears. Hear a break coming on. Let's take a short break here, folks. Let's come back, refresh, come back. Richard Heinberg joins us in a moment. Thanks.
The Zoomed Leadership Conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership, capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com.
If you are looking for creative ways to improve your bottom line, tune in to Make Your Move with Alan and Brian Bolio. Their proven track record of helping businesses enhance their profitability will provide the basis for a forum about actionable items based on a business person's perspective. The program will be business talk, but with an economic context, so you'll know how to stay ahead of the game. Make Your Move is broadcast live every Monday afternoon at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, 1 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Zoomed Leadership is sponsored in part by Cosmos Journal, the journal for world citizens creating the new civilization. More than just a publication, Cosmos is committed to informing, inspiring, and engaging the world in the transition to an emerging, sustainable, just, and compassionate global culture and civilization that works for all. For over 10 years, Cosmos has been a leading voice that tracks the deep systemic transformations already occurring at the margins of society as our institutions prove unable to serve the needs of the times. Published twice a year in print and digital, Cosmos includes leading-edge articles from social change leaders on the global commons, people power, global governance, new economics, collective intelligence, and cultivating the self. The impact of these paradigm-changing ideas is enhanced through stunning visuals and photographic stories that motivate to action. Start exploring Cosmos Journal and continue opening your perspectives about leadership and the emerging great transition at cosmosjournal.org. Join the Cosmos Leaders of Change and make a difference today.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back on Zoom today, Richard Heinberg, our guest, the end of growth, our focus and topic, adapting to our new economic reality. Richard, we set the stage, I think, for many of the listeners in our first segment here, but maybe we can actually bridge back and get your take on this as well. I've been having conversations and I've been bringing forward my own perspective for some months about potential scenarios, what the world might look like going forward. What's your take on it, given this more broad context and the realm that you're describing? What are the larger views? What are the pictures of possibilities and scenarios that you see?
Well, you know, the fundamental problem we have is, as we were talking about earlier, this enormous debt overhang. We've created a huge credit bubble, and that debt overhang actually represents an enormous number of claims in the scores of trillions of dollars worth of claims on assets. And ultimately, those assets come down to natural resources, human labor, manufactured products. And the claims outweigh the stuff that is being claimed. So somehow or another, those claims are going to be destroyed. A sizable proportion of those claims are going to be destroyed in the years to come. And I'm not talking about decades, but the next few years, this decade.
And what do you mean by, just before you go on, though, Richard, what do you mean by claims destroyed? Just so our listeners get that. What tangible means, what are you actually describing?
Well, there are two ways that can happen. One is through defaults and bankruptcies, and that tends to produce deflation. In other words, when loans are defaulted upon, basically a bunch of money just ceases to exist. Claims just go out the window. And those defaults could happen as a result of, companies like AIG just, failing to be able to cover their liabilities. Or they could happen as a result of a deliberate process of claim destruction, let's say by governments or central banks or something like that. Generally speaking, this looks like deflation. And in other words, we over time we have less and less money in the economy. That tends to make money actually worth more, but people's incomes also decline pretty dramatically. So it's the last time we had deflation was in the 1930s, and you know, folks know that it didn't look very pretty. There's one other way for claims to be destroyed, and that's for them to be inflated away. If governments engage in, you know, what's colloquially called printing money, it actually doesn't involve printing presses. It's all done with computers these days.
You're right.
But if governments just, you know, create lots of new money through issuing bonds, then that lowers the value of the existing claims. And it can happen quite dramatically. In my desk drawer here, I have a 100 trillion Zimbabwean dollar note.
And you have one of those, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of cool to have $100 trillion sitting in your desk, but it's actually worth, I don't know, 50 cents or something.
Mm-hmm.
That's what can happen with hyperinflation. Claims on real assets can more or less be inflated away. People's savings would be inflated away in that case. So these are the two kind of general scenarios going forward. Now, it looks to me as though currently the world is veering away from the hyperinflation scenario for the most part. We're seeing some substantial inflation in China. But in the European countries and in the U.S., the bond markets are hammering the countries with high debt, and the political option for hyperinflation is generally being discouraged. Certainly in the U.S., with what we've seen in Washington over the past couple of months, all the talk about reducing the deficit and reducing liabilities to future, you know, Medicare and Social Security recipients and so on. All of that is inherently deflationary. If the U.S. follows through on that, our economy is going to shrink, and there will be less money to spend in within our economy. So I think over the short term we're probably headed toward the default and deflation scenario. That's not to say that if things got really bad, the printing presses wouldn't get turned back on again.
Well, yeah, and that's what it seems to me like, that the propensity to avoid hyperinflation is real, and the propensity or the desire of the markets to push back on this stuff is actually very real. But it seems to me at the same time, Richard, that what we're seeing is the nature of our government and Chairman Bernanke in terms of the Fed. While they're being slow to get there, it still feels to me like there's a tendency to avoid depression at all costs.
Right, yeah. Well, of course, the Fed is now saying that they're going to keep interest rates rock bottom for the next couple of years. But, you know, the Fed and the Treasury have pumped an enormous amount of liquidity into the U.S. economy over the past 3 years, and the actual inflation that we've seen as a result of that is pretty negligible. That suggests to me that the deflationary headwind is really strong, and some people call this pushing on a string, you know, the Fed trying to pump all this money into the economy, but it's not really making up for the toxic assets still on the bank's books and the general deflationary headwind.
Right, yeah. And we had some conversations some shows ago. James Rickards was actually suggesting that part of the reason we're not getting inflation is that we're actually exporting it in many respects to China. And because China hasn't really dealt with the peg of their exchange rate relative to ours, they've kept it artificially low, that we're actually exporting it and really we want it back but haven't been getting it. But that's a whole other conversation. We don't need to get into all
that. Yeah, that's an interesting point of view, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot on that. But, okay. Okay, so we have scenarios, possible deflationary, possible inflationary, possibly one leading to another, and we have this world of declining growth or flatline growth, and I think you described that in the book. You're not suggesting so much that this is a steep curve down, but maybe you can say a little bit about expectations, Richard, about what growth might look like. Might it be flat, or is it slowly down? Does it ever go up again? What's your sense?
Well, we've seen over the past 4 years a mild recovery that we purchased with several trillion dollars of new debt. I don't think we're going to see more of that. The economy seems, and I think this is at this point a more or less general observation, that the economy seems to be more or less flattening out and may be heading back down into recessionary territory again over the short term. The prospect exists of a dramatic fall, a loss of confidence. We have to remember, all of this is in the end a sort of confidence game.
Yeah,
that's what money is all about. Everyone has to have confidence that even if our money consists of gold and silver, we have to have confidence that that's really worth something. But then when our claims get so abstract, where they're bets on securities, on and all of these things are many steps removed from the real stuff that actually is worth something. In that case, the potential for loss of confidence or loss of faith in the system is very high. Consumer confidence has just hit almost all-time low as of, I believe, this report of yesterday. And this suggests that there is a very real prospect for a fairly dramatic economic contraction. Of course, this no one wants to see that. But, looking forward, I don't think we can, overlook that possibility.
So when you're saying a dramatic fall, you're meaning economic contraction, contraction in growth, and then I've got to imagine at the same time you're talking about the consequences and the what goes with it, which is a dramatic fall in the markets, the financial markets, and the nature of wealth at the same time. Are you combining both there?
Exactly, because investors invest with the expectation of returns, and if the understanding were to settle in generally among investors that, looking forward, we're looking at a shrinking economy, suddenly a lot of bets would go sour all at the same time, and we would see an event probably on the same scale as September 2008 and possibly much worse this time. That possibility already exists, just as a result of the weakness of the European economies right now, with the possibility of not just Greece and Ireland and Portugal needing bailouts, but now Italy and downgrading of the credit rating of France. I mean, these are countries that are certainly too big to bail out, and so if we start to see one of them go south, then again we could see a pretty dramatic and rapid credit contraction event, and fairly soon.
And Richard, I've been talking about sort of the three large realms that some of our other guests and some of the futurists and some of the scenarios work out of the National Intelligence Council has put forward, and really describe, just as you've talked about, hard times being one sort of bucket, one scenario that we're trying to deal with it, but we face hard times. Another one is that it's even more gloomy than that, that we could ultimately realize the unthinkable, and that is a various forms of collapse, whether in government or various forms of society. society. And then the third is a much more expansionary view, the possibilities, and perhaps we can't even get there anymore because we haven't addressed this in this way. I hear the music in my ears. I know we want to take a short break here, but when we come back, I'd like you to weigh in on that. And hard times, collapse, what's possible, and moreover, what might we need to do, and what would you suggest to our listeners in terms of getting ready? So let's take a short break, folks. Come back. Richard Heinberg continues second half of the show in a moment, but return momentarily. Thanks.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Are you tired of the government squandering your tax dollars on bailouts and overpaid bureaucrats? On Free Markets with Dr. Mike Beitler, Mike Beitler and his guests explain why big government regulations are the problem and innovative businesses and free markets are the solution. Listen to Free Markets with Dr. Mike Beitler, Thursday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific on the Voice America Business Network. Zoomed Leadership is sponsored in part by Cosmos Journal, the journal for world citizens creating the new civilization. More than just a publication, Cosmos is committed to informing, inspiring, and engaging the world in the transition to an emerging, sustainable, just, and compassionate global culture and civilization that works for all. For over 10 years, Cosmos has been a leading voice that tracks the deep systemic transformations already occurring at the margins of society as our institutions prove unable to serve the needs of the times. Published twice a year in print and digital, Cosmos includes leading-edge articles from social change leaders on the global commons, people power, global governance, new economics, collective intelligence, and cultivating the self. The impact of these paradigm-changing ideas is enhanced through stunning visuals and photographic stories that motivate to action. Start exploring Cosmos Journal and continue opening your perspectives about leadership and the emerging great transition at cosmosjournal.org. Join the Cosmos Leaders of Change and make a difference today.
The Zoomed Leadership Conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, here we are back on Zoom today. We are talking about the end of growth, the implications of it, and I just really put forward to Richard some of the summaries that we have been exploring here on Zoomed about the scenarios that we have broadly put out there and that we've looked at from the hard times collapse to expansionary perspective about the realm of possibilities and redesign and what that might be. But Richard, your take on it, though, where might we be heading and what are those scenarios, hard times and collapse, if that unthinkable is actually thinkable. What's your take on those two in particular?
Well, we're certainly headed into hard times. I think there's no question about that. In some ways, that might be the best case scenario. A collapse scenario is very difficult to really think about. But on the other hand, it's not outside the realm of a possibility, as we were saying earlier. But you know, if we want to think about those words in more real terms and not just as sort of abstract symbols, I think it's helpful to look at societies that have been through hard times and or collapse in in relatively recent times. I'm not talking about going back to ancient history, and see what life was like during those times and how people coped and how they got through. For example, hard times. A good example of that is the Great Depression in the U.S. Another example of that is Cuba during the 1990s. And in some ways, the Cuban experience is pretty instructive because it was a problem of energy. Cuba had relied on cheap oil from the Soviet Union all during the 1980s and was very dependent on cheap oil for agriculture, transportation, and so on. They got their oil subsidized. They were getting it at less than world market prices from the Soviet Union. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, this was a huge economic problem for Cuba. They couldn't operate their industrial agricultural programs anymore. They, ordinary people couldn't afford to use motorized transportation and so on. So over the course of the 1990s, the Cubans called this the special period. They had to relocalize their agriculture. They had to train a whole generation of young farmers. They had to, start growing gardens in the middle of cities and find new kinds of transport options. They were breeding oxen to replace the big old Soviet tractors. So they were able to get through those hard times. It was a stressful period. The average Cuban lost about 20 pounds of body weight during that time. But as far as we know, nobody actually starved to death. It was not the kind of human tragedy that it could have been. So I think there are some things we can learn from that experience. There are also examples of collapse. For example, Argentina, a little over a decade ago, went through a hyperinflationary period. They saw essentially a currency collapse. Their currency became worthless. And in a situation like that, trade becomes almost impossible. So people have to rely on barter. They have to rely on whatever they have stockpiled. Rates of crime went through the roof in Argentina during that period, and in some ways, the country still hasn't entirely recovered from that situation. There are interesting books that are available from people who lived through those times. The Soviet collapse, for example. There's a great book by a friend of mine actually named Dmitry Orlov. And I'm looking for the book on my bookshelf, and I might not be able to find it in time. Oh, yes, it's called Reinventing Collapse. For folks who want to know how the collapse of the Soviet Union, the experience of people in the Soviet Union during their collapse might be relevant to what we have in store today, that's a really good example. And then there's a book by a guy named Ferfal, F-E-R-F-A-L, that's a pseudonym, that talks about his experience in the collapse of Argentina back in 1999-2000. And he has recommendations for what folks can and should be doing in the U.S. right now to prepare. I have to say his book is a bit dark because he spends quite a bit of his book talking about, what kinds of weapons you should stockpile and so on. Some of the things he recommends, I hope we never get to that point where that kind of advice is useful. But nevertheless, I think, if for people who are taking this seriously, it's useful to know what can happen to a society if its economic system really fails.
Well, so you've hit three big pieces here relative to Cuba. One has to do with food. Relative to Argentina, trade becomes impossible or becomes very challenging, very difficult. You've got the dark side of it with security and what happens there. And as I recall from Dmitry's book, he was actually even contrasting some of the differences in the Soviet Union infrastructure-wise versus the United States. And we're so spread out and sprawl-based compared to some of what they had with a more city-based orientation, if I remember correctly on that, that we've got some struggles with that in terms of transportation and how we actually localize from that standpoint. But, Richard, can you say a little bit more then, just in terms of a synthesis or summary of that, about what people might do? You've given some great references, but how would you summarize where people might put their attentions to get ready?
Right. Well, what all of these people mention is the importance of getting to know your neighbors. The people around you are going to be the people that you will be depending on, and you don't want to have a situation where the people next door to you are, you know, you don't know them, they don't know you, there's mutual suspicion and fear there. You want a situation where you're sharing tools, sharing garden produce, helping each other out, looking out for each other. If there are, you know, strange folks roaming through the neighborhood, you know, opportunistically, you want to have other folks within the neighborhood aware of that and looking out. So the way to prepare for the kind of situation we're talking about is not by just, you know, hunkering down and stockpiling stuff. Everybody should be, you know, should have a couple of weeks' food and water and so on, just in preparation for the kinds of foreseeable natural disasters that occur in almost every part of the country. But what's more important is to have a kind of social resilience where we are in touch with the people around us and have confidence that the people around us are looking out for us as well as themselves.
So this feels like it's a very much community, localized, the resilience from the fabric of connection with others, and thinking about the we here and not so much about the I and my sort of a protective stance. I'm hearing a real we here, Richard.
That's right. And, you know, that's part of the tragedy of the last few decades here in America. We've kind of wrung that out of our society. We have so many suburbs in the U.S. where people just do not know their neighbors at all. And so we have to rebuild some of that fabric. Back a few decades ago, you know, every town in the U.S., even very, very small towns, had Chautauquas and, you know, public lectures and band concerts in the summer and so on. People looked out for one another, and they knew how to have fun together. There was local culture. That's kind of evaporated from the smaller towns of the U.S., and in the big cities, we have this sense of anonymity where, yeah, we have cultural events, but it's, you know, there are subcultures within the city where people talk to each other, but they're not geographically based. It's not on the basis of neighbors and neighborhoods in many places. There are exceptions to that. I think Portland, Oregon is a good example of a town that still has neighborhoods and neighborhood culture, and there are others. But it's really important to have that. That's going to be the lifeblood of our society going forward.
And so with that as the core and the fabric, core to the fabric and the thread of it, Richard, what about some of the things, the infrastructure elements that we're so used to and reliant on? We go to the grocery store to buy our food. We, you know, willy-nilly just expect that there's plenty of fuel. We drive. I mean, what's your sense of the core infrastructure and what we might be looking forward to and preparing for? And we only got a minute here left before the last segment, but maybe get started.
Yeah, this is a big subject, and we're going to need more than a minute. We're going to be less mobile, so that means we're going to have fewer transportation options. There will be fewer of us flying, and flying is going to be more expensive. Fewer of us are going to be able to afford to own our own personal automobiles and put gasoline in them. That means it's, once again, it's going to be important for us to know how to carpool and car share. Maybe only having a couple of cars in a neighborhood will seem like a luxury in 10 years. And you know, we schedule and when we want to use the car, and we share in making the payments for the fuel and upkeep. I think that's the kind of future we're headed toward. It would be great if we all had, you know, robust public transit options, streetcars, and so on. But unfortunately, you know, we haven't made those investments as a society, and it's going to be pretty difficult to play catch up with that.
So great, Richard. Well, I know we have a hear the music in our ears here. I know we've got the one final segment. Let's take a quick break. Let's come back, folks. I still want to cover what this world, new world, might be looking like, not only from how we prepare for it, but what about the quality that might be in the world and the life? Let's return with Richard. Last segment, just a moment. Thanks, folks.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Zoomed Leadership is sponsored in part by Cosmos Journal, the journal for world citizens creating the new civilization. More than just a publication, Cosmos is committed to informing, inspiring, and engaging the world in the transition to an emerging, sustainable, just, and compassionate global culture and civilization that works for all. For over 10 years, Cosmos has been a leading voice that tracks the deep systemic transformations already occurring at the margins of society as our institutions prove unable to serve the needs of the times. Published twice a year in print and digital, Cosmos includes leading-edge articles from social change leaders on the global commons, people power, global governance, new economics, collective intelligence, and cultivating the self. The impact of these paradigm-changing ideas is enhanced through stunning visuals and photographic stories that motivate to action. Start exploring Cosmos Journal and continue opening your perspectives about leadership and the emerging great transition at cosmosjournal.org. Join the Cosmos Leaders of Change and make a difference today. Have you planned for your retirement yet? If you are a public sector employee, perhaps not. Studies have shown that employees of schools, educational institutions, governments, nonprofits, and public safety may lack the information they need to effectively prepare for retirement. For the answers you need, tune in to Lessons in Retirement, Retirement Planning for Public Sector Employees with host Jim Bishop, broadcasting live every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. It's sure to pay off in your future.
The Zoomed Leadership Conversation today, as well as shows both past and upcoming, are intended to illuminate perspectives on the great transition in motion, the extraordinary era of change that is affecting all of our personal lives, our organizations, our communities, and our governing institutions. Big shifts are happening, and more are coming. Some can be foreseen, but many are outside current paradigms of thought. All, however, ultimately will be shaped by new and expanding forms of leadership, capable of holding the widest possible views and the deepest forms of interconnection. Join Zoomed host John Schmidt weekly as he rides the rising wave of intelligence, moving us all toward a world of immense potential, dynamism, and economic, social, and environmental renewal. Zoomed is sponsored in part by Avastone Consulting, a source point for development of leadership and organizational resilience and sustainability for the last 25 years. Find John and his colleagues at Avastone via avastoneconsulting.com.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Zoomed Leadership with your host, John Schmidt. For more information about John and our program, visit avastoneconsulting.com. That's A-V-A-S-T-O-N-E consulting.com. Now, back to Zoomed Leadership.
Okay, back last segment today, Richard Heinberg, The End of Growth, its implications, what our world might be. It might be challenging, it might be tough, but there are positives on it, as Richard was suggesting, relative to the community. But Richard, let's go back here just for a second. I started pointing the direction, the big conversation about infrastructure and how we really deal with each other and what we might want to do and how that, any further thoughts about that? We're running out of time in that last segment, but other thoughts that you have in that realm first.
Yeah, well, certainly our food system is going to be problematic because not only is agriculture highly fossil fuel dependent, but our food distribution systems are highly dependent on diesel fuel for running, you know, the 18-wheeler rigs that pull up behind the grocery store every day to stock up the shelves. So the more local food self-sufficiency we have, the more of a local food infrastructure that we develop, the more secure our food system is going to be, the more we can grow our own food in our backyard gardens. You know, not very many people are going to be able to grow all of their own food in their backyard. But as we showed during, you know, World War I and World War II with the Victory Garden movement, back in those years, Americans were growing like 40% of their fruit and vegetables in their backyards. And so there's a lot that we actually can do, and it will be really, really helpful.
So that really comes back to the nature of community resilience, which is connecting with others and thinking about some of these core needs and needs to support each other in it, food being one, ride share and shared transportation, moreover with that. You're painting a picture here, Richard, that sounds to me like it's challenging, but it feels to me at the same time that there's a fabric of possibility in this, as we might even get to know people and get connected with people in a different way. What's your feeling about this and where we go, and how do we begin to engage each other in thinking about this?
You know, I think part of it is making a making it as inviting as possible. Those of us who do see what's coming, you know, it's sometimes there's a tendency to dwell on the scary bits and to sort of forget about or gloss over or not explore the possibilities, as you say. Building local community resilience, I think, is most effectively done through the arts and through, you know, throwing block parties and neighborhood parties and cultural events where people, you know, have fun and get to know each other in an atmosphere of relaxation and enjoyment. Here in Santa Rosa, over the last 3 or 4 years, we've had some local artists created this event called the Handcar Regatta. And it takes place on the old railroad tracks that go through Santa Rosa. And people spend all year building these unbelievably beautiful, intricate hand cars. You know, some of them are like giant hamster wheels with people running inside them. And, you know, I could go on for many minutes talking about the extraordinary hand cars they build. But hundreds of people show up at this event, and it's all about hand-powered, non-motorized stuff. And people wear costumes from the 1890s, early 1900s. It's the whole steampunk aesthetic phenomenon, and people have a great time. But in the process, you know, we're building this community, this awareness, and even an aesthetic around a kind of post-industrial or post-fossil fuel future. And I can't emphasize enough how important the cultural aspect of this is.
So that's a cultural underpinning. That's putting it into a very positive, enjoyment, joyous kind of an experience. Richard, I'm curious also, and our listeners would be, about the experience of moving toward this. There's the cultural side of it, but the practical and the tangible side of it. And on break, you were talking about and used the language resilience circles.
Right.
I wonder if you could say a little bit about that and what you really mean about that for our audience.
Yeah, well, that's actually a program that was started back in the Boston area, and it's spread out all over the country. And so, you know, if you want to just Google resilience circles, you'll find some information on this. It's basically a program for people to invite their neighbors over and just get together and talk about the economy and what the implications are and how folks can get to know each other better and help each other out. It's a really non-threatening, non-ideological kind of program that, you know, gets people together and gets people talking. I think it's a really good thing.
And people are flourishing then across the countries then. And, I mean, you're just talking about any Tom, Joe, Tom, Dick, Harry, Joe, Sally, Cynthia, so forth. Anybody who was really just coming together to be able to have the conversation, which is framing up the economy, energy, the environment, the realities of it, and then just saying, so what might we do together
what
and
can
let's
we do?
Begin to share. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the next step, you know, might be the formation of a transition initiative in a town or a city to begin to get the whole town off of fossil fuels proactively and build up the kind of community resilience we've been talking about. The transition initiatives, I think you've probably talked about them on the show already. They're springing up all over the place. There's over 400 transition towns around the world right now, and they're still going like wildfire.
And, Richard, do you have any suggestions in those places where they take about how they connect and where they're really getting viewed favorably by local governments, local power base and structures? How is that working to have what starts as a resilience circle begin to even get into the fabric of the community at large?
Well, you know, I think it's important not to start with politics because politics is so divisive, particularly in the U.S. these days. We have to get to a point where we can talk to each other again without getting into shouting matches, because a lot of what we're shouting about is, you know, we really all have the same basic interests at heart. We all want secure communities for ourselves and our children and grandchildren. But unfortunately, we've gotten into this highly polarized situation where, you know, we talk different languages, and there are these crazy symbols and messages and subtexts that we throw at each other all the time. So getting together outside of that political kind of debate context, I think, is really helpful. The resilience circles are good for that. The transition initiatives are good. And then once we've actually done some work at that level, finding out where we do agree and what we can do together, then there's the basis for programs, initiatives, and ideas that can be taken to policymakers who may be of one political persuasion or the other.
It, you know, Richard, you're describing this. We've had conversations on the show, but it sounds like this is really a movement out of the commons, not out of business and the private sector, not out of the public sector. This is coming out of people getting together with each other out of the commons, influencing this beyond politics. Sounds like there's a rich potentiality in that to boot.
Yeah, well, I think that's where the only lies, quite frankly. If we go on the way we're going now, where we're becoming more polarized as a society and we're relying on an economic model that has no future, I think the future looks pretty dark, quite frankly. It doesn't have to be that way. The seeds of a much better future are already there. They're not generally discussed in the mainstream media all that much. But that doesn't mean they're not there. So it's important to focus on what does work and make the most of it.
Richard, fabulous. I really encourage everyone to get the book, The End of Growth by Richard Heinberg. I think it's rich, provides a context, provides something valuable, and I think it illuminates more of what we've even talked about here today. But again, Richard, my thanks to the good work you've been doing over the years in all the books and bringing this kind of perspective to us here on Zoom. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Well, thank you, John. Bless your heart.
Yeah, well, thanks. Listeners, as you all know, where Richard left off as well as beyond polarities, and as I was talking about last week, beyond small ball in terms of politics, and you know what I mean by that, but it does come down to our own exercise of leadership with ourselves, with our families, with our local communities, as Richard's pointing to, the neighbors, those in the resilience circles. It is our leadership and exercising that has tremendous influence on the possibilities going forward. forward. Out of time here this week, folks. But again, Richard, thank you. Delight to be on. Continue the conversation at home in your own arenas, and continue. Zoomed continues with more guests and our ongoing conversation. Have a great week, folks, and enjoy.
Thank you again for listening to Zoomed Leadership with host John Schmidt. Please be sure to join us again next Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. And have a terrific week.